This is Voice of the Cape Drive Time. Going places. Getting there.
91.3, welcome back to Voice of the Cape Drive Time. Representatives of Libya's rival factions who've been sitting in Tunis and negotiating their way through a United Nations brokered process announced late yesterday that they had formed a unity government aimed at stemming the chaos that has engulfed Libya for the past few years. To try and understand whether this is going to mean something, we're joined online by Jason Pack, political analyst and founder of LibyaAnalysis.com. Is Jason online? He's not quite online yet, but we're going to be discussing the fact that representatives of Libya's rival factions who are sitting in Tunis and have negotiated their way through a UN-brokered process announced late yesterday that they had formed a unity government aimed at stemming the chaos that has engulfed Libya for the past few years. Online is Jason Pack, political analyst and founder of LibyaAnalysis.com. Jason Pack, welcome to the show.
Always a pleasure.
Now, looking at what's just happened now, we've just got the news that Libya's many factions sitting in Tunis, they have agreed to some kind of unity government. First off the bat, do you think this is going to last?
I don't. And I wouldn't even call it a unity government. What it really is a ministerial list. The 9-person presidential council have picked 30-odd ministers. However, two of the members of the presidential council, particularly those connected to General Haftar, the anti-Islamist strongman in the east, have withdrawn from the presidential council and don't agree with the list. So this list is not representative of the many factions that are trying to be brought together by this unity government. So it's almost like it's a stillborn list.
It almost looks like somebody got a roll of sellotape or duct tape and tried to stick something together.
Well, in fact, you're hitting at a really good point. This GNA, or Government of National Agreement, is something that's been imposed by the UN and the international community on Libya. It does not represent a authentically Libyan bargain, bringing together, for example, the Libya Dawn and Dignity factions. That's not to say it's a bad idea. Any attempt at unity is a step in the right direction, but as you pointed out, the government is not based in Libya. No one will provide security for it. It doesn't command any militias as of yet. So it's difficult to see how it's going to govern the country and unite the various factions.
In fact, the report that we've got from Associated Press has got a rather strange paragraph in which it says, according to the UN brokered deal, I'm reading it now, it says, the new government should be based in Tripoli. I nearly fell off my chair when I read that.
Well, that is a condition of the Libyan political agreement. The government can only come into force, as it were, once it's based in Tripoli. However, Tripoli is controlled mostly by Islamist militias who oppose this government. In addition, there are Islamic State cells that operate in Tripoli, and it's quite likely that would the government seek to return, or if not even return, but to go to Tripoli, that it could be derailed by spoiler attacks. And therefore, the only way the government or the ministers could support themselves would be through international peacekeeping forces. So it's been largely speculated that one of the first acts of the government will be to call for international intervention on its behalf against the Islamic State, meaning that the reason it was set up is in fact to give legitimacy and cover for international attempts to fight ISIS inside Libya.
So what we're dealing with here is people that might, in one sense, have Libya's best interest at heart, but at the same time, their one eye is looking at a completely different agenda.
Yes, the international community is focused on fighting the Islamic State in Libya and has not been focused on really genuinely bringing together the political factions and forcing them to make the hard decisions to move forward. To explain things even further, you need to get into the dimension of oil. And the Libyan factions are less concerned about fighting the Islamic State and more concerned about monopolizing control over Libya's oil resources. And it's a very complicated story, but suffice it to say, in the last days, the Eastern government, the House of Representatives, has, through various machinations, made a deal with Egypt to market some oil directly to Egypt in support of Haftar and various anti-Islamist factions. This is opposed by forces in the west of the country. So how can the National Unity Government come into being when it doesn't control the oil and the two previous governments, the House of Representatives and the General National Congress, are fighting over and making competing deals with different groups to sell Libya's oil? So we've gone, instead of from two governments to one government, from two governments to three governments.
That certainly is becoming a right royal mess. Some people are saying that we need to look, stand back and look at history, that before the colonial era, Libya was not Libya. It was, in fact, two different entities. Let's put it that way. Do you think we're going to have to go to the West-East or East-West model?
Well, Libya was, of course, three Ottoman provinces, Tripolitania in the northwest, Cyrenaica in the east, and Fezzan in the southwest. There are many groups advocating for that, particularly in Cyrenaica. These federalist groups, led by Ibrahim Jadran and the Petroleum Facilities Guard, would like, of course, to have a separate Cyrenaican entity, be it within a federal Libya or as an independent state, and that's largely because Cyrenaica has the vast majority of Libya's oil resources. I don't think that's a viable model because the infrastructure, whether it's pipelines or water, crisscrosses Libya, and it wouldn't make sense to just divide it up. However, Libya as a state has ceased to function. It is, in my mind, no longer a sovereign entity, and therefore some kind of alternative solution needs to happen. I think it needs to be rebuilt from the local level, not necessarily the provincial level, but local councils, local militias governing their areas and working together in a bottom-up fashion, rather than the UN imposing a solution top-down. This is the prime minister. These are the ministers. Go run the country. That's this top-down model that I think can't work in Libya.
So how would one be able to go about doing the bottom-up model? Because I'm pretty sure that if we were to go and talk to any Libyan person, whether they were in Benghazi or Tripoli or wherever else, that they would probably agree with us, but would probably start scratching their heads when it would come to the actual implementation. How do we do it?
Well, it's got to be a patchwork of local security and local governance arrangements. So Benghazi, there's a fight right now between various jihadist groups and Haftar's army. And there are different security arrangements in Misrata and in Tripoli. Those arrangements, the local people are invested in them. Allow and empower them to elect local leaders as they have in local councils, and then have those local councils and local leaders negotiate with each other to deal in larger blocks. Difficult to explain in a short radio interview, but
obviously
that could be an arrangement in which people are vested in, because it starts at the local level, close to where their concerns are, and it gets the men with the guns involved in governance. What happens now is a guy in a suit is manufactured by either the UN or by some kind of political process, and he's put in a chair. He doesn't control men with guns or people close to the citizens in the local council. So, of course, these men in suits have no power, and that's why I don't even like referring to the ministerial list that's been proposed yesterday as a government. It's 30 names as an attempt to compromise between different regions and factions inside Libya, and the guys who are selected have no power and represent nothing.
One almost wants to ask the question, why do the men in suits allow themselves to be put into the positions in which they are, when probably in the back of their minds they know that they are going to politically at least enjoy a very short shelf life?
That's a great question, and you've hit it, something that's key not only to Libyan political dynamics but others in Africa, Asia, Latin America. And this is lack of experience of governing and lust for power. So a wise man would know that he couldn't accept the portfolio of oil minister or prime minister because he'll have no power and he might be killed and he'll just be shuffled out in a few weeks. But someone who doesn't know about governance says, oh, wow, this means I can get my cousin this job, or I can send my wife abroad for medical treatment or whatever, or I get to sound cool. I'm the minister of infrastructure of Libya. And those petty personal motives are largely the reasons why people accept these positions. And the really powerful people are not in the ministerial positions. They're working behind the scenes, and they're cleverly manipulating the international alliances because they know that sitting in that chair is a recipe to be kidnapped or to be undermined. And Libya has always, under Gaddafi and even previously under the Italian colonialism, had a experience of shadow government and informal power being more powerful than formal power. Gaddafi, for example, said that he was not the president of Libya. He was just its brother leader, and that he had no position in the government. And that was, of course, fake. He was a pretty much all-powerful autocrat. But he did so informally through outside networks, while in theory, the basic people's congresses and general people's congresses ran the country, but they actually held no power. So Libya is again doing this dance between informal, tribal, militia power, and then some straw men in suits who are manipulated by those actors but hold official titles.
How many of Gaddafi's former men have filtered back into the whole mosaic of what is now Libyan politics? Are they there, or are we looking at a playing field of new actors, and some of them, it seems, fairly naive?
Another great question. It depends on who you talk to. If you talk to the hardcore revolutionaries, many of whom are Islamists, they'll say, the former Gaddafi guys are everywhere. We still haven't completed our revolution. If you talk to people on the anti-Islamist faction, they'll say, the former Gaddafi guys are all in exile, and no one with skills and experience has been allowed to occupy positions. And this is actually the primary divide between Libya Dawn and Libya Dignity. Dignity, or the anti-Islamists, want people who served in ambassadorial posts or water ministry or things like this, technocratic skills, from the Gaddafi period to serve now. The hardcore Islamists and revolutionaries want to throw out all those guys, have a complete de-Ba'athification, as it were, and start fresh. The problem with that is then there's no one with any experience or knowledge or traveling abroad or Western education. And that's seen as necessary to run the country. So the truth is in between those two viewpoints. And I'm worried that a lot of former Gaddafi officials and tribes and individuals who don't have blood on their hands are not being utilized because they are Libyan. They have a stake in the system. And anything which calls itself a national unity government has to bring itself together. And as we're speaking to a South African audience, I always like to mention the Truth and Reconciliation Commission legacy. I called in 2012 that when Libya had a relatively functional post-Gaddafi government, that they should establish a Truth and Reconciliation Commission to try people who had blood on their hands and gross actions of corruption, but then to find out those people who were associated with the Gaddafi regime who were just doing their jobs and, say, running the water ministry. That never happened, and Libya hasn't dealt with those tough issues, so everyone is suspected. And if you're suspected of being associated with the former regime, a militia may come and take over your house or kidnap your daughter, and that means that people who have a degree of public-spiritedness are terribly afraid and flee the country and go to Italy and Britain rather than trying to rebuild Libya. So if the National Unity Government could actually stand up and get moving, one of the first things I think it should do is initiate some kind of truth and reconciliation process.
It's interesting you say that because, you know, if one looks at what happened under Gaddafi and all this, what happened in the prisons and all that kind of stuff, that if any country needs to start looking at itself and indulging in a process of self-healing, because that's the only way you're going to heal yourself, it's just got to be Libya.
Yeah, that hits the nail on the head, that the massacre at the Abu Slim prison in 1996, where about 1,000 political prisoners and Islamists were killed, is something that many Libyan families still feel connected to, and that no justice has been done for that. Yes, Qaddafi's sons have either been killed or are sitting in prison in Zintan, like Saif al-Islam is, and Abdullah Senussi, Qaddafi's spy chief, was tried and convicted. But there hasn't been a larger process where the hitmen and the executioners and the torturers have been brought to justice. And that's why many current Libyan militiamen feel justified when they ransack somebody else's house and steal their personal belongings or goods. You can't really respect private property or have a sense of rule of law until these buried injustices are dealt with. Unfortunately, now there's no functioning judicial system or impartial courts to deal with it. And it was easier to do just in the wake of Qaddafi's overthrow, when there was a degree of hope and buy-in by the people. Now the Libyan people are terribly cynical. They don't trust any of these institutions. And I think that they have a long and hard road ahead, where things are going to get much worse before they get better. And that has to do with the Islamic State, which we've barely mentioned, but is totally on the move and looking to make Libya its backup capital, a place where it can flee its top people as they're being chased out of Syria and Iraq, and conduct more attacks. So it's a very dire forecast for Libya indeed right now.
It certainly is, and the ISIS or whatever one wants to call it, I can only predict that it's going to add to what I already perceive as a whole society that is suffering from post-traumatic stress syndrome. In South Africa, I feel that South Africa is still a post-traumatic stress syndrome country. You know, you can't wipe out 300 years of colonialism and 48 years of apartheid in 20 years. It's just not possible. And one's heart can just only go out to Libya, who've also been hammered quite seriously by colonialism and Gaddafi and everything else in the last, let's say, 200 years.
That's a very good point. And whenever I'm speaking to policymakers or to general audiences over the radio, I stress that it's impossible for any society to have had a complete root and branch revolution, throw out the bad guys, and create democratic governance in a few years. So Western policymakers who expected or demanded that were dreaming. Think of the French Revolution. It led very quickly to Robespierre and the guillotine. And then, when that failed, Napoleon came in as an autocratic general. Only 70 years later was a modicum of democracy and the principles that the revolution had been about put into place. So I think it's really important, as you've said, to not judge the Libyans too harshly, because they've been through a lot, and it's a natural human process that a new generation needs to come into being, and things get worse before they get better. So that's why I'm not a long-term pessimist about Libya. I'm a short and medium-term pessimist, but Libya is an underpopulated country with vast oil resources. The Libyan people are relatively educated. They have a good geostrategic location at the center of the Mediterranean, at the center of the African and Middle Eastern systems. So in the long term, so long as they can kind of keep their act together and not have the country, you know, governed by jihadists, it might be better for the next generation.
Jason Pack, political analyst, founder of LibyaAnalysis.com. Thanks for talking to us about Libya and a UN brokered process we feel isn't going to last for very long. But of course, nice to really talk about all the issues. Jason Pack,
always
thanks a lot.
Always a pleasure to be on Voice of the Cape. Talk to you next time.
Thank you.
This is Voice of the Cape Drive Time. Going places. Getting there.